It is the morning show. I'm Glenn Moberg in for Kate Archer Kent. In the next hour, we're going to look at the historic alliance between two of Milwaukee's ethnic minority groups, an alliance that changed the region's political landscape in the 1960s. Allied in the Fight, Jews, Blacks, and the Struggle for Civil Rights. It's a new exhibit at Jewish Museum Milwaukee commemorating the 50th anniversary of the sometimes violent battle for fair housing in the city. Now, in just a bit, we'll be hearing from Molly Dubin. She's the curator at the museum. But first, for some background, we turn to Patrick Jones, Associate Professor of History and Ethnic Studies at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln. He's also the author of Selma of the North, Civil Rights Insurgency in Milwaukee. We do want to hear from you if you'd like to weigh in on this subject. Do you remember the civil rights era? Were you involved in civil rights protests? Did your religious or moral convictions lead you to get involved in the civil rights movement, even if you aren't African American? And do you remember the housing marches in Milwaukee in the 60s? And maybe you're involved in some social justice causes today. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Patrick Jones, thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
Let's start with Milwaukee. It is the 50th anniversary of the Great Marches for Fair Housing in the city. There are a number of events commemorating it this year. How significant were those marches?
Well, they were tremendously significant, not only locally, in terms of challenging one of the most significant dynamics of the kind of northern system of racial inequality. So they played a great part in a local and state transformation, ultimately after more than 200 days of marching leading to a local ordinance being passed. But they really played a catalytic role in the ultimate passage of the kind of what I call the Forgotten Civil Rights Act of the 1960s, and that's the 1968 Civil Rights Act, or what's more popularly known as the Fair Housing Act. So the marches gained great national attention. Folks came in, as they did in Selma, from all over the country to participate in those marches. It spurred all kinds of discussion nationally. The figure of Father Grappi, the peculiar white Catholic priest, playing a kind of central lead public role in them, also spurred quite a lot of curiosity and discussion nationally.
They had an impact not just on state law or a local ordinance in Milwaukee. Those marches had an impact on the passage of a federal law.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, housing is one of the core issues in the northern struggle for racial justice, and it's a place where many whites took their stand against racial change. It was a difficult struggle to get legislation passed in 1968, and Martin Luther King's death is a catalytic moment. But when folks like Walter Mondale and other liberals in the Senate are debating the bill, they point to the open housing marches in Milwaukee as an example of what may happen if we do not act on this, not only an example of the extreme segregation in the North, housing segregation, but also the virulent white reaction that came against the peaceful marchers in Milwaukee and the racial conflict that it elicited was, an example for many across the country of what the cost of inaction would be, that this issue had hit a tipping point and action needed to be taken. And so on the floor of the Congress and the Senate, as they're debating it, Milwaukee is raised up as an example of why federal officials need to take action to make change, and that's why I say it's an important catalytic moment. Just like Birmingham leads us to the Civil Rights Act and plays that kind of role, the Selma Voting Rights Campaign plays an important catalytic role in getting us to the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And I would argue that Milwaukee deserves its place in that national narrative as a local struggle that plays into and plays an important role in helping gain passage of a very important and significant and often overlooked federal law.
Well, your book, Selma of the North, Civil Rights Insurgency in Milwaukee, of course, focuses on that Wisconsin city. But there were marches going on in Chicago, in Boston, a number of places during the 1960s. You really feel that Milwaukee deserves to be put on kind of a pedestal or raised up as an example for what was happening in the 1960s?
I do. For a lot of reasons. At the time, it gets a lot of attention, and we can forget that. It's in national media. Father Grappi and the Youth Council and Commandos are on national television shows talking about what's happening. Milwaukee is a particularly sharp example of northern racial discrimination, the levels of unemployment, impoverishment, housing inequality, education inequality are some of the most severe in the whole country at that time. It's an important kind of example of what is a broad national problem in urban America. Then you have the figure of Father Grappi, this peculiar white Catholic priest who's playing a leading role and raises all kinds of issues about what's black power. Can a white guy be a part of black power? It raises important issues for Catholics, the largest Christian denomination in the country, about the role of a priest. The Catholic Church is going through tremendous change at the time with the Second Vatican Council reforms. There, it's a highly debated set of issues. Christians in general and religious folks in general, white folks, are discussing, you know, to what extent should we be involved in this? What's our responsibility to be a part of struggles for justice? And the most salient one at this moment in time is the African-American freedom movement. Later, the anti-war movement would raise similar questions and other struggles for justice of this era. Milwaukee exemplifies certain things that resonate with a lot of local areas and play into key national themes at the time. And in terms of Dr. King in Chicago, you know, he's in Chicago the year before the open housing campaign in Milwaukee, and he's largely a failure there. He is attacked by whites. They get an agreement, but it's not a very strong agreement. He essentially leaves town disappointed, and it's a real question about whether his version of militant nonviolence can be applied successfully in the context of the urban North. And many see in Milwaukee kind of, as Bell Phillips said, the last stand for an integrated church-based nonviolent movement. And Dr. King himself does not come to Milwaukee, but he telegrams Father Grappi and the Youth Council and Commandos and says, you guys have found it. You found the way to apply militant nonviolence to this urban context, something that he was challenged in having difficulty doing in his own work. So on a lot of different levels, I think Milwaukee is really important, and it opens up critical ways of thinking about the civil rights movement and that we don't normally think about, since we're often single-mindedly focused on the South or major spots like you mentioned, Boston or Chicago, which all have their importance.
Well, Patrick, you're talking about cross-cultural alliances here. You've mentioned Father Grappi, and there are, of course, others. How important were those cross-cultural alliances to the entire civil rights movement in the 60s?
Yeah, well, I think they're critically important for a lot of different reasons. One is that we're in a context in the United States, unlike, say, South Africa, which has a majority black population, that in most areas in the United States and overall nationally, there's a large majority of white folks. So just in terms of the politics and when it comes to moving legislation and moving power and things, there's a need to have coalitional politics to gain the numbers necessary institutionally to do what you would like to do in the civil rights movement. So there's a pragmatic kind of political need for cross-racial cooperation and alliance building here. I think also, you know, we have to keep in mind that, as Dr. King said, that the goal of the civil rights movement was to relieve the oppressive circumstances that people of color found themselves under. But really, as he said, it was about redeeming the soul of the nation overall to help the nation live up to its best ideals, but which it didn't actually live to in a pragmatic day-to-day basis. And race was, you know, one clear example of that. And so, you know, we're all hemmed in by race, and the humanity of white people is degraded as they degrade people of color. And so the idea was that the civil rights movement would liberate all of us, white people from the constraints of whiteness, black people from the results of racial oppression and white supremacy, and that thereby we as a nation would redeem ourselves to our best values And so, you know, a lot of white folks get involved for moral reasons. They're thinking deeply about their religious commitments and then what that leads to in terms of getting involved in these emerging movements at the time.
Some of the most important cultural alliances and events of the civil rights movement involved some very significant figures as well. I'm thinking of Rabbi Abraham Heschel, and also Stanley Levison.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Heschel becomes a very close and quick friend of Dr. King. He's called on often by Dr. King. Heschel comes from a family history of discrimination in Europe and a consciousness of how if you do not combat evil in the world and injustice in the world early and for yourself and for other people, that evil can spread very quickly and evolve into something like the Holocaust. Those memories of European pogroms and the Holocaust are still very fresh in people's minds and experiences in this post-World War II era that we're talking about. And so particularly the Jewish community, particularly Rabbi Heschel, has a family history of that, a community history of that. He's a leader in the Jewish community, a theologian. And he sees, again, like many Christians did, white Christians, here was a stand that needed to be made, and we have to get involved. So there's theological issues, there's historical and personal dynamics for why people get involved, but certainly the religious community is really critical in these kinds of coalitions.
And can you explain the concept of ecumenism and how that played into the involvement of religious people in the civil rights movement?
Sure. You know, in the 1960s, part of the liberal politics of the 1960s, particularly among liberal branches of the various Christian denominations and Judaism, was this idea of kind of cross-religious cooperation. And so you could be a Methodist or a Protestant or a Catholic or Jewish, but there was a need to work across these lines of difference as well, and that at the core of the various major faith traditions were some fundamental shared values, a belief in one God, that kind of golden rule, treating people with basic dignity and equality, what we would call maybe today social justice. And so there were a lot of efforts to bring people of different faiths, interfaith councils, various organizations that tried to bridge those gaps between religious denominations, which, you know, throughout human history, religion has been often a very divisive institution as well. And so an awareness of the need to come together and that religious communities could have a particularly compelling moral voice in the important struggles of the day, too.
And the Freedom Summer was an intentionally interracial effort.
It was, and that one is an interesting one because the student activists and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee are having struggles with their voting rights campaign. They decide to invite white, middle-class, largely college students from the north to come down, knowing that essentially black lives don't quite matter, particularly in the rural south at the time, but that the lives of white, middle-class college students mattered more in the society, and that their parents, who are largely, you know, professional class folks, if they were put on the line for civil rights, that the attention of the nation would be redirected and action may come from that. So you get kind of, during Freedom Summer, this interesting interracial experiment among local people, activists in SNCC, and then these white college students that come down. And there's lots of great things that come of that, learning and connectivity. And there's also challenges because, you know, one of the things that happens is that within SNCC, white people tend to kind of dominate the space. They're acculturated to speak up and to lead and to talk, and black folks have been acculturated to be deferential to white people. And those patterns, even within the civil rights movement and in this interracial experiment of Freedom Summer, begin to play out.
And SNCC, SNCC, of course, stands for Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. We've got one last question for you, Patrick, and then we've got to let you go. This interreligious and interracial collaboration that we saw during the 1960s and the civil rights movement, is that ancient history in America, or is it still going on today?
No, I think it's clearly still going on today. It's contested as it was then. I mean, you had a Father Grappi and kind of liberal-minded, reform-minded Catholics, but you also had, you know, thousands of white Catholics in Milwaukee who were the bulwark of opposition to civil rights. And so there's always been a kind of tension within what we might generally call more conservative and more liberal or progressive traditions within American religious denominations over social change and progress and particularly social justice movements and participation in them. So, you know, the religious right today, conservative religious ideology that often opposes change, gets a lot of media attention today, but there are plenty of prophetic religious progressive voices out there. I think of William Barber in North Carolina as a really stunning example of that, leading up a new Poor People's Campaign and the Moral Monday Crusades there. So there are plenty of folks, but that tension and that internal discussion about who we are as people of faith, what's our responsibility to the world beyond our denomination and to issues of injustice continues to be debated and contested, often hotly. So I think we just have to look and we can see it.
Patrick Jones, thanks so much for being with us today. And as you mentioned, the Christian right, well, there's also a Christian left. Patrick Jones is an associate professor of history and ethnic studies at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He's the author of Selma of the North, Civil Rights Insurgency in Milwaukee. It is The Morning Show. I'm Glenn Mobergen for Kate Archer Kent. When we return, we'll hear from Molly Dubin, the curator of the Jewish Museum Milwaukee, about its new exhibit, Allied in the Fight, Jews, Blacks, and the Struggle for Civil Rights. It is The Morning Show. I'm Glenn Mobergen for Kate Archer Kent. We want to thank Patrick Jones of the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, the author of The Selma of the North, Civil Rights Insurgency in Milwaukee, for joining us in the first part of this program. Joining us for the rest of the show, we've got Molly Dubin, curator at Jewish Museum Milwaukee. She helped create the current exhibit, Allied in the Fight, Jews, Blacks, and the Struggle for Civil Rights. And for disclosure purposes, WPR is a sponsor of Jewish Museum Milwaukee's ongoing events, Redlining, Racism, and Reflection, a three-part series. So we want to hear from you. Do you remember the civil rights era, the things that Patrick Jones was talking about that happened in Milwaukee in the 1960s? Were you a part of it? Were you involved in those protests? Maybe you were on the other side. Maybe you were one of the people or your family members were who were protesting the protesters. Did your religious or moral convictions lead you to get involved in the civil rights movement, even if you aren't African American? And are you involved in social justice causes today? Our lines are wide open. You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Now, Molly Dubin, the exhibit you curated at Jewish Museum Milwaukee is called Allied in the Fight, Jews, Blacks, and the Struggle for Civil Rights. Why did you choose the phrase Jews and Blacks instead of Jewish Americans and African Americans, or is that even significant?
Well, Glenn, that's a good question. And this exhibit really came about due to coming across some information about an exhibit that some of our colleagues on the East Coast had put together. So that title actually came from a core body of material that we were able to utilize. They have in their collections, these are organizations such as the American Jewish Historical Society, the Leo Beck Institute, the Yeshiva University Museum, and these were collections that spoke to the height of the civil rights movement. And so we were able to reach out when I came across some information because we were really interested in exploring this topic of the relationship between the Jewish and Black communities. and they were very amenable to letting us kind of look at their information, utilize it. So that was really where the title came from, and we were able to use that and then go on to create a larger component that really spoke to the Milwaukee experience, connected to the larger narrative, the national stage, and some of the unique experiences in Milwaukee, and to also really frame the 1967-1968 open housing marches, of which we were at the 50th anniversary of celebrating.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that 50th anniversary. There are events commemorating it across the city. It's called 200 Nights of Freedom. How significant were those marches and the civil rights struggle that was happening in Milwaukee at the time?
Incredibly significant. Just to give a little kind of background to how that came about, of course, Vell Phillips in our community, who is known as a civil rights pioneer and a pioneer in so many different areas, first presented in 1962 to the Milwaukee Common Council this idea of a fair or open housing ordinance. And Vell presented that ordinance four different times, and she was the only positive vote. The fifth time, she did have some others voting in the favor, but it wasn't an ordinance to the extent that she felt was necessary, so it was defeated a fifth time. So it really was those marches and the commitment to 200 nights, whatever it took to make the city realize, the people in the Common Council and in the, you know, halls of politics, to understand that we had an issue that needed to be dealt with, and the time could no longer be put on hold.
Black residents in the city back then were pretty much confined by de facto segregation to a small north side neighborhood known as the Inner Core. For those who don't live in Milwaukee, what's the neighborhood? What was it like then, and what's it like now?
Well, so that area was really known as I think you're referring to the Haymarket District, which originally was where the Eastern European and Russian Jewish communities settled after kind of the big migration from Europe and Russia. So that Haymarket District is 3rd to 12th, Juneau to Walnut. And then the African-American community followed suit. And so that was a shared space. You referred to the fact that there were restrictions in place. We get into talking about redlining and racially restrictive covenants in the exhibit and, of course, in some of our upcoming programming. And this was an issue in terms of access to education, jobs, which of course is directly tied to your ability to improve your lot in life, your opportunities. And while that was a shared experience, you know, in the early 1900s, the Jewish community was able to kind of transcend that following World War II with the GI Bill and kind of the big move to the suburbs, whereas the African-American community really kind of hit a wall in terms of housing access and mobility. And so it was really necessary to look at how that could be changed to provide more access, more opportunity.
But we're talking about, you know, segregated neighborhoods. And during those protests, the 16th Street Bridge was a focal point. Some called it the longest bridge in the world, linking Africa and Poland, a reference to the neighborhoods on either side of the structure. Talk about the role that bridge played in the struggle.
Well, that 16th Street Viaduct, which is, of course, now known as the James Grappi Unity Bridge, was a significant site, as you said, that was often referred to as the longest bridge in the world, the Mason-Dixon line of Milwaukee. And it really was this iconic site because not only was it, you know, this represented this, you know, physical division, but also in crossing that, it spoke to the idea that there was so much more than this physical barrier in terms of all the protesters that the marchers were met with on the other side, and that, you know, crowd increased with every night of the marching. So that is a significant focal point and I think an iconic site for Milwaukee and for Milwaukee in terms of being a barometer and a focal point for the nation at that time.
Now, there was one night when marchers crossed that bridge and they were met with violent resistance on the other side, and their civil rights headquarters, the Freedom House, burned down. Tell us about that.
Well, there's several different stories about, you know, what happened there, but that led to, you know, certainly some rioting and what was a curfew that was instituted at the time for a while, and the marching was put on hold initially, but then it was determined that it couldn't stop. It had to move forward, regardless of, you know, the curfew that had been put in place, regardless of, you know, the legalities that might be involved in terms of arrests, in terms of, you know, trying, you know, groups or individuals, organizations trying to put a stop to that. It was just determined that they had to take that and use it in gaining strength and for the movement and for continuing this initiative.
And here we are 50 years later, and Milwaukee is still one of the most segregated cities in America. Why is that the case after 50 years and after all of this struggle and in some cases bloodshed?
Well, you know, it's interesting. And, you know, that was one of the things we really wanted to look at with this exhibit is, of course, to observe this important event and point in our history that was so significant for Milwaukee and for the nation. But it really is important to look at in terms of the greater narrative and advocacy and how we can work together. And one of the things we were watching while this exhibit was being developed were things like what was going on in Charlottesville. And you look at some of those images and you take out some of the modern, you know, backdrops, and these could be images from the 50s, 60s. And that's really disconcerting. And so it was important for us to present this exhibit to, you know, recognize this important point in history, but also to understand that in order to move forward, to affect positive change, it is critical to understand where we came from. And that while progress was made, and certainly the 1968 Civil Rights Act, which included fair housing, was signed, there are still substantial racial issues in Milwaukee. We still have a major gap in home ownership between whites and blacks. We are recognized as the most segregated city in Milwaukee. So it is so timely for us to be looking at these issues and understanding that we've made progress, like I said, but there is so much progress still to be made. And we're hoping that this is a means of engagement and spurring dialogue.
Well, let's talk about the central theme here, Jews, blacks, allied in the fight. The civil rights movement began in earnest right after World War II, so Jews in the U.S. had the Holocaust and oppression in Europe fresh on their minds, and they saw black Americans experiencing oppression as well, and they made that connection. Is that right?
That is true, absolutely true. And really, it goes back even further. We talk about in the exhibit that the alliance really is cited as beginning at 1909 with the establishment of the NAACP, which was established by a group of both black and Jewish white intellectuals. And we use that as kind of the point of launch and look at how immigration was a factor, shared spaces were a factor. Parallels in the narrative in the pursuit of basic civil liberties and rights. And certainly coming off of World War II and communities in the United States and certainly in Europe reeling from the devastation of the Holocaust. And all of a sudden, but certainly it became clear that, hey, we're abroad fighting these issues. We're fighting Nazism. We're fighting racism, anti-Semitism. And we've got these issues in our own backyard. There was this huge discrepancy between, you know, what was being touted as the American dream and what that all represented and what the realities were, certainly for the African-American community. And the Jewish community, having, you know, just undergone these huge events of atrocity, were appalled by what was going on. And as part of what is really a Jewish tenet to, you know, help be involved in social issues and advocacy, they immediately got involved with trying to figure out how they could help to combat that.
Well, you mentioned the founding of the NAACP and that Jewish intellectuals helped establish it. Was it because Jews weren't viewed as white at the time, or was it because there was some sense that Jews and African Americans struggled with some of the same problems?
I think it's probably a combination, but more in terms of the latter. The NAACP really was founded to a great extent with an initial initiative to, you know, fight what were the horrible lynchings that were going on and events that were happening in Springfield with at the home of Lincoln. And that really was, you know, something that was a breaking point for a lot of people in watching what was going on in the United States. But it was also about fighting for some of the basic constitutional rights. And those stories, those pursuits are very parallel for the Jewish community and for the Black community. They are minority groups with shared struggles. They're shared experiences, but also, to be clear, there are experiences that are unique to each community. But it was that idea that there should be equality, there should be accessibility, there should be freedoms, there should be basic protections in place for all people. And I think that was really the major coalescing point.
Let's go to Karen in Fish Creek. Karen, you're on The Morning Show with Molly Dubin.
Hi. I have a unique perspective on the 60s in Milwaukee. I was in grade school living in Wauwatosa, the closest suburb to Milwaukee, and grew up with two very conservative parents. But I have a strong memory that in sixth grade, I knew what was going on, and I heard about the hunger hike, which was a 30-mile hike through the neighborhoods of Milwaukee to support the Black community. And I went around our neighborhood and got sponsors to do the hike, did it against my parents' wishes, and did it completely on my own and completed the 30-mile walk around Milwaukee. And I really do think that helped shape my future life and my future views in being able to be so involved as a young person and doing it on my own. And so I have just interesting memories.
Yeah, Karen, were your parents opposed to the civil rights movement? And if they were, how did they react when you participated in the march?
Well, I wouldn't say they were necessarily opposed, but they did not see the need for it. And they've remained conservative all their life, and I've seen their views get more extreme, which is very sad. And I really had to, they didn't forbid me from doing it, but they were not happy about it and did not support me in doing it.
Karen, thanks so much for the phone call. Molly Dubin, your reaction to what you just heard.
Well, Karen, first of all, thank you for calling in and sharing that experience. That has been one of the tremendous things that I've been able to glean in working on this project is all of the memories and experiences. And there are so many in our community and people from such varied backgrounds that have come forward to say, you know, I was aware of what was going on, and I wanted to be part of it. And really not uncommon for parents of younger people to not want them involved, simply for the fact that it could be dangerous. And certainly it was, you know, opposed to what the status quo was, what was comfortable, what was understood. So I can understand that. But she touched on a very important point, which was that, you know, the civil rights movement, to a great extent, was about young people, was about young people understanding that there needed to be shared civil liberties, rights, protections, equality for all people. And it's the young people who brought the passion, who brought the enthusiasm, who, you know, who bucked the system, if you will, who, you know, who, even though their parents were saying, we don't want you to be doing this, understood the importance. And for so many, it did shape some of the, you know, very fundamental growing years of their lives and in shaping their thoughts and opinions. And that's why it's so important, as we talked about a little bit earlier, for our current and future generations to be coming in and understanding this time, because they are the ones who are going to need to pick up that torch in terms of trying to figure out solutions for affecting change.
We are talking with Molly Dubin, curator at Jewish Museum Milwaukee, who helped create their current exhibit, Allied in the Fight, Jews, Blacks, and the Struggle for Civil Rights. It's part of a citywide commemoration of the 50th anniversary of Milwaukee's marches for open housing. It's the morning show. I'm Glenn Mobergen for Kate Archer Kent. We'll be back with more of your questions and comments after this short break. The morning show. I'm Glenn Mobergen for Kate Archer Kent. We're back with Molly Dubin, curator at Jewish Museum Milwaukee, who helped create their current exhibit, Allied in the Fight, Jews, Blacks, and the Struggle for Civil Rights. We're talking about the historic alliance between Jews and Blacks in the city on the 50th anniversary of Milwaukee's sometimes violent struggle for open housing. If you remember the Civil Rights era, if you participated in the protests, maybe you were on the other side. Maybe you have family members who are on the other side or family members who participated. Give us a phone call. We're also interested if you're involved in social justice causes today. That's 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. That email address again, ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Nick in Hartford. Nick, you're on the morning show with Molly Dubin.
Hi, thanks so much. It makes perfect sense to me why the Jews and the Blacks would work together, because, I mean, it was a crime against humanity what was done to the Jews, and it was a crime against humanity what was done to the Blacks from Africa. I mean, this is like, I think we have such a huge ingrained problem of racism in this country that we don't even realize, like, it was, you know, a murdering and a genocide and slavery of people, and it wasn't even that long ago.
Nick, thanks so much for the phone call. Molly Dubin?
Well, I couldn't agree more. It's a topic that is so resonant on so many levels. And, you know, as I alluded to a little bit earlier, while we were developing this, you know, fortunate for the dialogue, which is so important, but unfortunately, we were getting a glimpse at all of this divisiveness that is going on around the country. And we felt like this exhibit was an opportunity to get people to engage in meaningful dialogue. These are issues that are uncomfortable. There's definite sense of being uncomfortable about talking. These are hard issues, and a lot of these are ingrained, you know, learned behaviors that need to be addressed. And we cannot address solutions, figure out solutions, if we don't go back to some of these fundamental, you know, blocks that were the issues at the heart of the civil rights movement that are still being grappled with today. And I agree, it makes a lot of sense. We talk about in the exhibit that this is certainly a relationship that has ebbed and flowed, and you know, there were periods that were filled with a little bit more strife, but the majority of the periods were really about collaboration and advocacy, and we feel like it's so important to focus on those positives, those collaborative things that brought about productive, you know, good inroads. And if we don't look to that past, we're not going to be able to move forward. So I so appreciate the, you know, the comments and the understanding that there were a lot of parallels. And It's something that, you know, as I say, is difficult and uncomfortable, but these are conversations that are critical, and particularly in our Milwaukee community.
Let's move on to Vivian in Green Bay. Vivian, you're on the morning show with Molly Dubin.
I'd like to point out that there were other groups that benefited from these struggles and efforts. When I moved to Green Bay from a farming community in Oconto County, there were few blacks in the 1960s, 63, 64 here. But at that point, I went to work for the Wisconsin Public Service Corporation utility, and their rule had been that once a woman married, she was fired. She had to quit. So the company had a lot of, you know, lifelong spinsters, a few opportunities for women because they had no structure for promotion because they didn't keep most of the women. Most of the young women got married and left. And when I mentioned this to people that the Civil Rights Act was important to women back then in just that simple regard, most people aren't aware of it.
Vivian, thanks so much for the call. Molly Dubin, this civil rights movement impacted a lot of different groups.
Absolutely, it did. Absolutely. And I caught a little bit of the earlier conversation that you were having and talking about, you know, certainly the March on Washington and the March in Selma and Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, who was linked arm in arm with Martin Luther King, praying with their feet, as he famously said. But there were representatives of every faith and culture and gender, of course, that were there. This is not just about blacks and whites. When we talk about basic civil liberties and we talk about the impact on our society and what's going on in our society today, these are issues that are affecting the LGBT community, certainly the women's rights. This is a huge topic right now, as well it should be. Again, it's brought up a lot of uncomfortable situations, but it's been a long time coming. And it's so critical to have these conversations. And I wholeheartedly agree that the civil rights impacted and is still impacting so many diverse groups.
And let's move to Kay in Milwaukee. Kay, you're on the morning show with Molly Dubin.
Yes, Wauwatosa during that time had an ordinance that homeowners could not rent or sell to blacks. However, it was different when you tried to plant tomatoes in your front yard. I remember a woman who planted tomatoes in her front yard, and Wauwatosa said, oh, it may be your property, but you can't plant tomatoes on it. And the other thing I must say, your earlier guest twice called Father Grappi peculiar. Father Grappi was a passionate activist, but in no way was he peculiar.
Well, I think our guest meant he was peculiar in the sense of being unusual. I don't know if he had a negative connotation to that. But Molly Dubin, your reaction to what Kay just said about what was happening in Wauwatosa at the time.
Well, it's interesting. One of the things that we look at, and certainly one of the things that we're appreciative of Wisconsin Public Radio for being a sponsor of, is this three-part series looking at redlining. And we have, you know, an entire panel that looks at the history and the continuance of redlining in many ways, in terms of language that has been grandfathered in or is still on the books in counties around the country. But we look back at timelines and some of the, you know, areas that had racially restrictive covenants in place, and there were in the 1920s subdivisions in Cudahy, Shorewood, West Milwaukee, Whitefish Bay, and Wauwatosa that continued into the 1930s with subdivisions in Bayside, Fox Point, Glendale, Greenfield, Hales Corners, St. Francis, and South Milwaukee. And in 1958, which was a decade after the, you know, landmark Shelley v. Kramer case, which outlawed racially restrictive covenants, there was a new subdivision created in Greendale that had a recorded statement about race restrictions in that subdivision. So this is something that is really important to look at. It's something that still continues to impact upward mobility and opportunity, particularly for the African-American communities.
Well, I'd like to read a quote that's on display at the Jewish Museum exhibit. This is from Mel Zaret, who was a leader in the community and the director of the Milwaukee Jewish Welfare Fund, which is now the Jewish Community Relations Council. Speaking to his board of directors in 1963, he said, and this is a kind of a long quote, he said, "Jews who are altogether familiar with the humiliation of being unable to sleep where they want to sleep, who were quarantined in ghettos for so many years, and still are in many places. Jews who were denied opportunities in all sorts of employment and still are in some places in our country. Who cannot join many social clubs, including some within our own city. Who have met hate and murder can hardly be onlookers when one of the great battles for freedom goes on before their eyes. We cannot pretend," he said, "that the insult to us in this country anywhere approaches the humiliation of the indignities to which the Negro is subjected." Now, Zaret said that to his board in 1963 before the fair housing marches in Milwaukee. Can you tell us, Molly, a little bit more about him and how that kind of sums up the entire exhibit at the museum?
Well, Mel Zaret was a tremendous activist for the Jewish and Greater Milwaukee community and involved with so many social justice issues. And I think, as you pointed out, this is a statement that was made to the board of the Wisconsin Jewish Welfare Fund and organization. And this is 1963. So, you know, this is really, you know, predating kind of a greater involvement in terms of the height, the primary years of the civil rights movement. And it really does sum up the fact that it is all of our responsibilities to come together to ensure basic civil liberties. And we are so much stronger as advocates. We are stronger if we can join our voices and work together to effect change. And Mel was really, you know, one of a number of individuals, including, you know, people like Dr. Jay Larkey, who we happen to have his doctor's bag on display in our exhibit. It's actually a part of our permanent collection. And Jay Larkey and his wife, Hinda, were very involved in the civil rights movement. Jay went on to really devote his life to social justice issues. But the bag is significant in that he set up a makeshift medical center in the basement of St. Boniface Church, which is, of course, where Father Grappi was assigned. And he treated marchers who were being injured, who were having bottles and tear gas thrown at them, along with all the horrible slurs that were being shouted. Hinda was very involved with a group called MUSIC, which is the Milwaukee United School Integration Committee. We have a great picture from an article in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Hinda with a number of other individuals who had chained themselves to school buses fighting for school integration.
There's a great deal of history there. And in just the few seconds we have left, Molly, what do you hope people learn from this history and from the Jewish Museum exhibit? What can it teach us about our country?
Well, I think it can teach us that when we come together, when we work together, when we recognize that our similarities are greater than our differences, and how we can make a greater impact in joining our voices and our actions, that it should inspire us to do that. And we're hoping that this does inspire dialogue, community building, engagement. And really, the last thing in our exhibit that visitors encounter is a wall, a board that's a call to action. And we're asking everyone that comes into that space to make some kind of a commitment to effecting positive change.
Molly Dubin is a curator at Jewish Museum Milwaukee. This hour of the morning show is produced by Colleen Leahy with on-air production by Niasia Ellison, technical direction by our executive producer Michelle Johnson. I'm Glenn Mobergen for Kate Archer Kent. Dean Kallenbach will be in tomorrow. It's been a pleasure hosting the morning show this week. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and thank you so much for listening.